Have you ever fallen in love with something only to discover later that that thing is not all it's cracked up to be? Like, have you ever had like a romanticized notion of something, something you held in high regard, only to have it fall back down to earth and stripped of its romance? Do you know what I'm talking about? Could be a person, a community, an object, a thing. Happened to me with my Dyson vacuum cleaner a few years ago. I bought it was great, and now it's having trouble sucking things up. I'm like, what happened? That sort of thing, you know, you sort of excited about something, and then you fall out of love with it. If you know that experience, I can tell you this. Kristen, my wife, she can point to a very specific moment where that was her experience with me. She can tell you to the second the moment when she fell out of love with me. It was a watershed moment for her when all the romantic feelings she had towards me suddenly dissipated, and she knew at that moment that the real work of love would begin. It was a November night, a rainy November night. We had only been married for a few months, and it was about 11 o'clock. I knew Blockbuster was open till midnight, and I thought, I don't want to go to bed. I want to make something of this evening. So I traveled to Blockbuster and rented JFK, Oliver Stone's JFK. If you haven't seen this movie, it's mind-blowing, but it's also like 3.5 hours long. It's long, it's intense, and you want to be prepared and ready for the final courtroom scene, the back and to the left scene. I mean, it's just intense. And so there it was. I had armed myself with an arsenal of snacks and watching the movie. Kristen's in bed, and I'm noticing it just feels hot from the intensity of the movie. And so I start removing layers of clothes. I'm at home, I'm in my recliner, what's the big deal? Over the course of the movie, I had ended up with just my underwear and one sock on. And I was scarfing down the chips, and it was that moment that Kristen woke up for some strange, odd reason. She came out of her room and took a look at me, and it was just the sound that she made. She just looks at me and went, ugh. And then carried on her way, went back to bed, and I was like, what was that about? I had chip crumbs all over me. It was kind of gross. And she didn't mention it until like a few months later. We were talking about a relationship. She's like, something shifted that night. Like, what are you talking about? She was like, it was like when I woke up, I found myself in front of some sort of odd art installation. It was like a contemporary piece on modern man. Is this what we have evolved into? A shaved gorilla covered in chip crumbs, gorging himself in front of flickering pixels. That's what you looked like, and it was revolting. And she said she knew in that moment as she went back to bed that something had slipped. My charm, my chakra, you could say, had suddenly disappeared. And she knew in that moment, okay, now the real work of love is going to kick in. Isn't that just the way of life? You know, we fall in love with people or ideas or things, and we romanticize notions of them, but those feelings, those ideals, they eventually slip away, and we're left with something that's far less spectacular. And I think that happens for a lot of us in terms of community. I think for many of us, we have a romanticized notion of community. I mean, community is a buzzword, right? Both in and outside of the church. Community, we're told, is what we're all looking for. Community. We're desperate for it as humans. We talk about community all the time. We need community. We should be community. And along the way, we picked up these romanticized notions of what that means, and we almost live in this state of nostalgia, don't we? Because all of us have these memories of a time where we feel like we experienced real community. Maybe for some of you, a small group. Others of us, it's camp. How many of people here are camp people? Oh, you're a particular kind of person. Yes, you camp people, they know that incredible feeling of intense communities. For some people, it's a mission trip, or maybe it was a time in university, college, whatever it was. For many of us, there are these moments and these seasons of life where we sense, what I'm experiencing here now, that's real community. And we sort of, throughout the rest of our life, think, why is community not more like that? And we long for that depth again. We pine for that sense of knowing and belonging. Beyond that, it's also not hard to pick up really romanticized notions of community in Scripture. I mean, when the church gets started in Acts 2, I mean, it just sounds so dynamic. I mean, this is the start of the church. It sounds like this. All the believers were together, had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day, they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes, ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God, enjoying the favor of all the people. It's like, wow. You look at a passage like that, and it's like, I yearn for that sort of connectedness, the kind of closeness and intimacy and that sharing of life. Or elsewhere in Scripture, there are these famous, they're called the one another passages, and I love them. There's 59 of them in the New Testament, penned by Paul, Peter, some others, and they're just brilliant, brilliant passages that speak to the idea of how we should enact communal living. Sort of, here's what we should aspire to. And the thing is, if you read them in isolation, it's hard not to wonder, why does this community not look like that? They're broken down in a number of ways, but a third of these passages are about unity, right? Being together, being one. Another third, they extol the virtues of loving one another. We just need to get together and love one another. 15% of them are just about serving each other and constantly putting others before yourself. And then there's a mix of other ones, everything from hospitality to intimacy to encouraging one another. And you know, you can read these things and it's easy to romanticize those ideas, to separate these words from the gritty realities of the communities they were spoken to. And then you show up here, and you listen to some music, and you listen to me, and then you go and you maybe talk about sports or weather with somebody else, and then you go home. And after a while, you think, well, the romantic notion of community we might have once had, it sort of feels a bit lost. Is this as good as it gets? The reality sets in, and the reality is this. Community is at times hard, boring, irritating. I like how Richard Beck defines community. He says it this way. It's standing around drinking bad coffee with people when you'd rather be someplace else. Now, fortunately for us here, we have fantastic coffee. But, same idea. It's standing around drinking coffee when you might wish you were someplace else. Community often looks like just standing around doing ordinary small talk, waiting for maybe something spectacular to happen. And at times it can feel like, well, I thought I signed up for a revolution with the Christian path, and all I got was small talk. Here's the thing. What I want to contend this morning is this. Small talk is the revolution. Well, I'm hyperbolically overstating my case here for dramatic effect, but small talk is so important. And I want to get underneath small talk this morning by addressing three simple questions. What is small talk? What does it do? Why is it important? What is small talk? I mean, this seems like the most obvious, simple of questions, but when you get at the mechanics of small talk, what you come to understand is that small talk is actually, it borders on miraculous. It's one of the most impressive features we perform as humans. Because the thing that is genius about the small talk is it's not just what we say, it's what we don't say. It's in the pauses, the gaps, the silent moments. The moment just between me responding to what you just said. It's interesting, when we engage in small talk, right, we take turns speaking. Speaker role flips back and forth. And it's an odd thing because there are no rules for this. We just instinctively understand how it works. But consider the mechanics of small talk. In small talk, each person's turn lasts for around 2 seconds. As in, good night. How about that weather, eh? Yeah, that quick thaw followed by a freeze was crazy. That's small talk, 2 seconds. But what is more remarkable is that the gap in between people speaking is 200 milliseconds. And this is a universal. The slowest small talkers apparently are the Danish. Their gaps are 470 milliseconds. The quickest small talkers are the Japanese. Their gap is only seven milliseconds, but on average, humans, 200 milliseconds. I don't know about you, but I find this absolutely amazing. It's the minimum human response time to anything, says Stephen Lewison. And it's the same amount of time that it takes for a runner in a race to respond once the gun goes off. Which is bizarre, because think about it. In that situation, there's only one possible response. Gunshot, start running. But in conversations, there are thousands of possible ways to respond, and yet it only takes us 200 milliseconds. I mean, think about that question alone. Hey, how about the weather? Well, you could think, how am I going to respond to that? But we don't. It happens almost instantaneously. What this means, as Ed Young says, is we build our responses while other people are talking. We listen to the words while simultaneously crafting our own, so that when our opportunity comes, we seize it as quickly as physically possible. And so when we small talk with each other, our brains are dancing together. We're not just listening to other people, we're actively predicting what people are going to say. We're listening for grammatical cues. We're looking for changes in pitch. We're developing our own response. Lewison highlights it this way. When you take into account the complexity of what's going into these short turns, you start to realize this is an elite behavior. Dolphins can swim fast. Eagles can fly high. This is our trick. Or Tanya Stiver says, everything points to what astute observers we are of every word choice, every phonetic change. And here's the thing. I know many of us in this room aren't the greatest fans of small talk, but whether you love small talk, hate it, find it boring, dull, it is amazing what's going on when we communicate. But what does it do? The first person that studied this was an anthropologist named Bronislaw Malinowski. I think I got that right. In 1923, he said this: a great deal of talk does not serve any purpose of communicating ideas, but instead serves to establish bonds of personal union. Then on, described it this way: it's purposeless expressions of preference or aversions, accounts of irrelevant happenings, and comments on what is perfectly obvious. I love that. It's not exactly a flattering picture of small talk, but he's on to something really important here. There's two kinds of speech: speech as communication and speech as social bonding. And this, to me, is where the power of small talk comes in. Small talk is the kind of speech we engage in most often. It builds up this bulk of verbal communication, but its purpose is social bonding. And yet so often, I think we dismiss it as unimportant. It was weird this week, of course, with the weather, small talk stuff. I'm out with my neighbors talking about the weather. It's the weirdest thing, because on a first level, it's crazy to me how when neighbors speak about weather, it's always, isn't that unbelievable? Would you believe this weather? It's unbelievable. And I always laugh in my head, it's not unbelievable at all. It's like this happens every January. It was, this is unbelievable. It was weirdest thing happened this week, though. I'm talking with my neighbor about the weather, and I see this guy running down the street. He runs down the street, runs by me, says a very derogatory comment to me, and just keeps running. Complete stranger. I don't want to tell you what he said. It was mean, but I was like, nice to meet you. All right. It was weird. Anyway, but think about that, a small talk about weather. It's not really about weather. It's about bonding. And I like what Justine Copeland says. She's got a fascinating book called Small Talk, whole book on small talk. But she says this about how we've created a hierarchy of language. She says, what primarily emerges from feminist critiques is the fact that Western societies have wholeheartedly accepted that communication is in fact value gradable, on a scale from most least authentic, or a scale from most to least authentic, or most to least valid. An evaluative public conception of communication itself is strongly in place. Real talk is talk that gets stuff done, where stuff does not include relational stuff. Fascinating. Small talk is the language of relationships. It's how we bind ourselves together. So talking with each other is not just about communicating ideas or getting stuff done. It's a social behavior. Robert says this: every speech act is an act meant not only to communicate something, but do something, reassure, acknowledge, nurture, enjoin, reject, dominate, encourage, or just feel awkward silence. Consider this small talk dialogue here that probably we'll engage in this morning. Hey, how's it going? Pretty good. How are you? Good. Okay, cool. See you later. See ya. Now, what's happening in an exchange like that? It's brief. It's dull. It has absolutely nothing to do with how the person is actually doing. There's very little content there. Oh, well, there's some content. I mean, presumably, if you're good or pretty good, you're not going to die in the next 10 minutes. But there's virtually no content there. But the primary interaction is all about doing something, making contact, reaffirming a relationship, letting the other person know they are noticed, expressing positive feelings towards someone, showing some sort of concern. That is in no way unimportant. It's not small at all. The content of the talk might be small, but the gesture and what it does is big. And I think as humans, oftentimes what we want more than anything is just notice me. Just notice me. Acknowledge me. It was interesting. I was talking to Kristen about this stuff. She's like, you know what? That's funny. I was telling someone in a random small talk conversation that I don't like cake on my birthday. I like pumpkin pie, which I had no idea of, actually. 13 years, I had no idea about that. Who doesn't like cake? But not listening well. She says, and that person on my birthday made me pumpkin pie out of a simple conversation chit-chat. They remembered that and made me pumpkin pie. And she said, that's never left me. I'm like, that's truly bizarre. But there's something there, that idea of just notice me, acknowledge me. You know, I sense that a lot of times on Sunday mornings here, right? It's not that you necessarily want to get into a deep conversation, but it's nice to be noticed and acknowledged. And small talk is about that. It's not about communicating ideas or information. It's about bonding, seeing the other person, noticing the other person, establishing a bond. Consider again the two New Testament passages here. I find these interesting. One is from the one another passages. First one is this: encourage one another and build each other up. And then Ephesians 4, do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouth, but only what is helpful for building others up according to their needs, that it may benefit those who listen. You know, it raises an interesting question. So what kind of language encourages, builds up, meets needs? I mean, there's probably tons of ways to answer that question, but one of the most basic ones would be small talk. Because in small talk, we do the basic but monumental task of simply noticing others. And that's encouraging. That builds people up. You know, the reality is, I don't think we're very good at that here. Murray is great, actually. He's a wonderful small talker. But I've noticed, for a variety of reasons, that a lot of times at Nexus, it's hard to connect in small talk, isn't it? Part of it might be fueled by my own paranoia and trouble making eye contact with people. I don't know, but it can be difficult in this room at times, I think, for people to feel noticed, acknowledged. And you know, it might sound like one of the most basic sermon application points you have ever heard in your entire life, but it also might be one of the most important. And what I mean is this: just talk to people. It can be about anything. It could be about nothing at all. But the simple act of speaking the words, how are you doing? Even if you don't care how they're doing, it does so much. And it might feel clumsy and awkward, but small talk is a social lubricant. It sort of greases the wheels of a relationship. Or consider sports, right? Sports, one of the most common forms of small talk. In all honesty, let's be honest about this. Sports are kind of absurd, aren't they? I mean, the amount of emotional energy we invest in some men chasing a ball or something around is kind of crazy. I'm getting worked up thinking about the Leafs right now. I mean, oh, the amount of emotional energy. And to be honest, the time and money we spend to play sports or watch sports is just so often over the top. But there's more to sports than meets the eye. It's Sports is to small talk, with cheese is to pizza, right? They sort of go together. What they do is it provides an opportunity to talk about something that's completely meaningless, which is precisely the point. Like how Robert sums it up here. He says, sporting events are a simulation of conflict with no serious consequences. Yet they generate enormous amounts of specific information. They are a content generator for small talk, easing the work of communion. I love it. Why a defense of watching sports? Small talk. I mean, imagine every Sunday when I saw you, the first thing I sort of said and did was, how is your soul? How are you really doing? You'd be like, yikes, man. Like, you need some conversational foreplay before that sort of thing can happen, right? It's like, whoa. And you know, sometimes for people to open up, it will take weeks, months. I think it sometimes takes people years before they're comfortable enough to actually move beyond small talk. And that, in my mind, is both what makes community so hard, but also what makes small talk so important. And so in small talk, the issue is not, can I find the most interesting or deep thing to talk about? It's finding the things that lubricate conversations, set people at ease. If that's the weather, so be it. By the way, we have some great weather talkers here. Is Lindsay Minoka here this morning? She is phenomenal at talking about the weather. Anyway, you want a good weather conversation, she's great to talk with. She studies weather. Anyway. And here's the other thing. If you are here this morning and you are good and fluid at small talk, I want to encourage you to thank your lucky stars. Offer up a prayer of gratitude for the tremendous gift you have been given. Because it's such an important skill. It's the glue of community. If you're good at small talk, we need you to exercise your gift here. We really do. It's a gift that needs to be valued and recognized. And for the rest of us, like myself, this might be something we need to learn. Because unfortunately, many of us are not good at it, right? And we're never taught this sort of stuff, are we? And if it isn't clear, I think, why small talk is important yet, let me add one more element. In this age of internet, social media, instant communication, now more than ever, we need small talk. Sherry Turkle, she wrote a book called Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. She claims that the best and most important parts of conversation are the boring parts. She says, you see, while we communicate today in multiple ways through text, email, social media, Facebook, Twitter, what this has meant is, she says, instant communication has come at the expense of conversation. She says, we're talking at each other rather than with each other. Think about the way we interact with social media. It's talking at each other. It's announcements like, I hate Donald Trump. I'm eating bacon. Eating bacon kills pigs. Here's my vacation. My kids are really cute. It's just a constant, let me talk at you. And I don't want to diss social media too much. It's amazing, but it's just sort of poof, float something out there. Talk at people, not with people. And what Turkle insists is this: what makes conversations tick is that they're messy. And that messiness is what makes them magical. Conversation is full of clumsy topic changes. Have you ever found that you're talking about something? You're talking about, oh, I'm talking about the sermon this morning, and like 5 minutes later, you're talking about kitty videos on YouTube. You're like, I don't understand how that conversation went there. Or it's full of awkward pauses. You know, when everyone's talking and everyone apparently at the same time runs out of things to say, and you're like, someone say something. It's clumsy. It's messy. It's not tidy. But it's this messiness that allows true exchange to happen. She goes on to say, the logic of conversations these days as it plays out on the internet, it favors showmanship over exchange, flows over ebbs. But that's not conversation. And so I love what she calls for, a celebration of the dull. She said, we need to celebrate the dull, the awkward and the clumsy. Because that's where true exchange happens. It's where community happens. It's where social bonding happens. And I couldn't agree more. I'm going to ask the band to come. as a close here, we have romanticized notions of community. We talk about community. We need community. But the reality is community is often hard, irritating, and boring. It's not sexy. It's not spectacular. It's no honeymoon. In fact, what community often means is simply standing around, drinking coffee, stumbling clumsily through small talk, wishing perhaps you were somewhere more exciting. And the thing is this, everyone wants to join a revolution, a movement, a cause they can believe in. Most people, though, don't have the fortitude to put up with the small talk necessary to make it happen. Most people don't realize that the small talk in church is the revolution. It's sharing life with people who are damaged and hurt in various ways. It's chit-chatting with people we are vastly different from. It's hearing stories from people that you've heard 10 times before. And there's nothing romantic about that. It can be dull, it can be irritating. But the kingdom of God is at work, and the kingdom of God is at hand here and now. It's difficult to truly see sometimes, because oftentimes what that looks like is coffee and conversations about the weather.